This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
On the side of a road, an hour's drive from the nearest city, a young father is making the hardest decision of his life. Wrapped in his arms, a baby boy with fluid on the brain, a condition that without surgery causes brain damage and can lead to death. The 21-year-old migrant worker wants to leave his son at a baby hatch, a drop-off centre attached to an orphanage.
Stop.
But the staff here won't let him.
Stop. We're allowed to do this. We're allowed to speak to him.
He walks away, defeated and distraught. As we begin talking to him, security intervene.
Just wait a minute. Who are you? Who are you?
The guards try to stop us filming.
You don't touch the camera. Don't touch the camera. Don't touch the camera.
As the father walks away, he breaks down in tears. Eventually he stops, sobbing.
He just wants to put him down because with the state there's still hope. His home doesn't have any money.
As the guards continue to harass us, our producer asks why he's been turned away. One of them yells, "We have rules. He's not from the city, so he can't leave his baby here." Unable to get help, he leaves, cradling his disabled son and a bag filled with baby clothes. Since this baby hatch opened in Jinan, eastern China, a month ago, it's been inundated with abandoned children. According to state media, in the first 11 days, 106 children were dropped off, all of them suffering a medical condition or disability. Many of the drop-offs are happening at night. And when a six-year-old girl was dumped from a moving car, social media erupted, increasing scrutiny of the 32 hatches operating across China. When this program was launched back in 2011, the government was happy to talk about it, believing it was addressing the problem of child welfare in this country. Well, now it appears there is a gag order in place, as everyone that we've approached to speak to about this subject has refused, saying they're not allowed. But one of the founders of China's child welfare policy strongly defends the program. "We had to work out a more humane way to accept these orphans," explains Professor Wang. "Babies were being thrown into trash cans on the side of the road and in front of hospitals because parents are too poor to care for them. That's why we built the hatches." The government claims there are 500,000 orphans, but experts believe the real figure is in the millions. And while there are plans to build more orphanages and foster care homes, critics say that's not the solution. Instead, they want China to improve its social safety net, so parents with disabled children are given medical, educational and financial support, so they don't have to resort to this level of desperation. Anna Corrin, CNN, Jinan, China.
That CNN report came out in 2014, 3 years after China introduced its baby hatch program. Good evening, I'm Caroline Oh. Today we're talking about abandoned babies and we explore why parents do it. Now in that CNN report we played a little earlier, the main reason seemed to be poverty. Our parents simply cannot afford the medical bills that come with treating their disabled children. And closer to home, the option of using baby hatches is not exactly top of mind, evident from the amount of abandoned baby cases as reported in the news. Now, a stat from the police that might startle you reveals that babies are found abandoned in the country every 4 days. For those of us who are privileged enough to lead relatively stable and comfortable lives, it can be a difficult phenomenon to relate to. It's hard to understand why a mother would abandon her newborn and what circumstances she would have been in that led to that act of depression. Now, our guests, Nur Aisha Osman from Orphan Care Foundation and Dr. Lai Swat Yun, Senior Lecturer, Gender Studies Program, Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at University of Malaya, joined Ezra and myself in this discussion. And one of the first things we asked was why people carry out this act of depression. Is there a sort of profile that's been drawn up based on existing cases?
in orphan care's experience, if we're talking about abandonment, that means the baby is placed in the baby hatch. So we don't really know the background of the birth mom, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if we're talking about mothers who want to make an adoption plan, and they come into the office, you know, we have a profile that says that, you know, according to percentage, it's about 8% that are below 18, about 50% are between 18 to 24, and above 30, it's 14%. And the cases where we don't know, that means they've been abandoned, they've really been put in the hatch, that accounts for about 11%.
Yeah, I think I would just like to add, cases that have been received shows that mainly the mothers are usually around, they're either teenagers, right, in their teenage, anything from 13 onwards, and also those who are in their early 20s. And in terms of the demographic, it was predominantly the Malay population. It's actually proportionate to their population in Malaysia, because sure. Malays are also the dominant group.
Right. So I can appreciate the fact that conclusive stats are perhaps difficult to come by, and
yes,
of course in
right.
this situation, almost impossible in some instances. But what do we know about why they do the, I mean, surely in order to address the issue, we must know where to start. So who are we addressing, and what do we know about why they do this?
I think the main reason is because of the cultural, which when I use the word cultural, it also includes religious stigma and shame associated with being with having premarital sex, and of course, you know, getting pregnant out of wedlock. And of course, also they do it out of desperation, really. Imagine you're a teenager, you know, 13, 14. And in Malaysia, it's taboo to also talk about sex. Our parents don't talk to us about sex. And in school also, it's not mentioned. And then suddenly, you know, the teenager found herself pregnant. It's a very frightening and confused state for her. And of course, uppermost on her mind, like, you know, sometimes out of desperation, not knowing what to do. And also the fear of being rejected by your family. Imagine your family turning you out. So due to that, I think they resorted to abandoning the babies, because then there's no telltale sign that they've been pregnant, right?
Are we seeing things change? Have they evolved a little bit?
In terms of whether things have changed, I think they the problem is actually, I think one of the root cause or that we don't address is also the blaming of women, the blaming of the teenage mothers. Because when they are being blamed for it, I think it's very hard for them to come forward and say, I have this baby, you know, and my boyfriend don't want me anymore, you know, can you please support? Right? I think it's very hard for them to do that when they know they're being blamed. And in Malaysia, as in many other countries, we know that there's a sexual double standard. It's okay for men or for guys to have premarital sexual relations. It's more accepted, right? They are being cheered on and, you know, looked upon as a stud. Yeah, but if it's women who are having lots of sexual activities, they're considered as promiscuous and loose and whatnot. So I think that kind of cultural mindset have to change so that girls would be better supported, so that they would be brave enough, knowing that if they step up and say, hey, you know, this is what happened, and knowing that they won't be blamed for it.
Just adding to what Dr. Lai has just said, you know, when a woman comes into orphan care, she mostly comes in alone without the support of her boyfriend or her family, and, you know, she feels betrayed by either the boyfriend or sometimes, you know, a fiancé. So she's left in the lurch and all that. So there's no support, and there's a lot of stigma associated with it. And imagine if you find yourself pregnant and, you know, your parents tell you they're not going to help you out. They can, in fact, be disowned sometimes. So that leaves them in a very helpless situation.
We mentioned earlier about this, that about nearly every 4 days a baby is found abandoned. Could it be that the numbers are actually greater than that because there's just not enough data and information to make sense of this entire situation?
I believe that's true because, you know, some cases don't go reported. For instance, like the statistics from PDRM, you know, on average it's like about 100 a year. But up to May, it was like 44 cases and only one-third of the babies were found alive. So I think a lot of cases, you know, just don't go get reported. So it may be a higher incident.
We'll explore what the future holds for these young mums. Can they move on with their life after having given up their child under difficult circumstances? More after this. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9.
The Business Station.
A study was done earlier this year by Dr. Salmi Razali, a psychiatrist and senior lecturer at Monash University. Using police statistics from 2007 to 2011, she says, number one, most of the parents abandoned their babies in the vicinity of their own houses at 22% of the total number of cases over the 5 years. Number two, roadsides and garbage areas account for 9%. Places of worship and rivers, ponds and beaches stand at 7%. 6% can be found in bushes and toilets and sewers, and 1% of abandoned babies are found in schools. Number three, only 12.7% of the perpetrators are identified and caught. Most worrying is that more than 40% of them are students, followed by those in non-professional occupations and those who are unemployed.
This is the Evening Edition, and you're with me, Caroline Oh. We're joined by our guests, Nur Aisha Osman from Orphan Care Foundation and Dr. Lai Swat Yun, Senior Lecturer, Gender Studies Program, Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at University Malaya. And we're talking about abandoned babies and why it happens. Now, earlier we talked about the reasons why young mums resort to abandoning their babies, and often it has to do with the fact that they're without support, whether financially or emotionally. And while they have to deal with the stigma attached to their circumstance and the negativity that comes with it, are they able to move on with their lives? Now, we asked Aisha, in her capacity as the person in charge of abandoned babies and adoption at Orphan Care, if some of these mothers choose to keep in contact with the baby that they've given up through the baby hatch.
There have been cases where they leave like a necklace with a cross, you know, so that indicates that, you know, they're Christians, or they just write a note saying, you know, date of birth or religion. But most cases, they just want to remain anonymous, you know. Perhaps once in a while, we'll get a call after a child's been placed. Just, I think this is a mom who's really, you know, looking out for the safety of the baby, you know, and they just want to find out from us that, oh, the baby's been taken from the hatch and safely placed with us.
Can I just ask very quickly about the significance of that distinction? So, say, for example, a mother leaves, like you said, a necklace with a cross it, and it identifies the baby as, you know, a certain religion and then the rest of it. Does it change the way that baby is then treated or handled? Or
Yes. We're assuming that the birth mom wants us to have the child being adopted by someone of her own religion.
Of the same faith.
Yes, of the same faith.
And otherwise?
Otherwise, if we do not have any information, then according to the law, that the procedures of JKM, Jabatan Kebajikan Masyarakat, then we would assume that the child is a Muslim. So we would place the child with a Muslim family.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about what sort of future awaits these girls. Do they have sufficient options available to them? You know, for a lot of these mothers, they might not get out of depression from this act of abandoning their child.
I think one very immediate thing is if you're a teenager, you know, been going to school and you're pregnant, I think one very possible scenario is that they would drop out of school. And if they dropped out of school, just imagine their future. They don't have very high academic qualifications, and they'll be a single mother. Just imagine trying to bring up a child on your own. In the case where they abandon the baby, I think then also the issue of guilt. It's not easy to leave your child like that, you know, it's your own blood. So the guilt feeling may be with them for a while. And, of course, you know, over time, the guilt could also turn into depression and whatnot.
But so. Is that a typical situation? I mean, you can imagine young mothers, yes. You know, with you know, full families, everything going swimmingly, they feel guilty when they go to work every day. So having to abandon, I mean, is that something you see depression quite a bit from these mothers who perhaps have had to give their children up?
They don't stay very long with us, you know, after they've delivered, or sometimes when they seek shelter from Orphan Care, they, you know, at the most a week after they've delivered, they would be already, you know, out on their own. But we do give them support like counselling throughout the stay with us, or as and when they need it. So that kind of support helps us, gives us an indicator, you know, on what areas we can help them with.
And perhaps, what are these areas?
Like, for instance, if it's a student, you know,
yeah.
then the counselor would always say, talk through with them, perhaps encourage them to
go back to school.
Go back to school. Yeah. And, for instance, those who are on looking out for a job, so provide them with resources for career guidance, job placement, you know. And at Orphan Care, we're not talking abandonment here. If a birth mom comes and makes an adoption plan at Orphan Care, we empower them with this sense of power and control in the sense that, you know, they can choose the couple that they want to place their baby.
Mm.
So in a way, that lessens their grief. Because in the adoption world, we have what we call the primal wound. That's the pain of separation or the trauma when, you know, after having carried the baby for 9 months and then to have to give the baby up. So that's something psychological and which every birth mom relates to.
It seems so, very much that the work that you can do involves very immediate, almost, it's almost putting out, it's almost firefighting. Right? You're doing whatever you can to aid the situation immediately. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to long-term assistance for these young mothers, what options are there out there? Are there any options?
I suppose, like, you know, when the counsellors talk to them and all that, it's to get on with their life, you know. And
do you find that it's sufficient?
We try our best, you know. I mean, if they've made an adoption plan, then we have to respect that and guide them along the way. And sometimes they just don't seek help from us. But we try to accommodate whatever their needs are. So if they don't ask for the help, we try to anticipate what their problems are and try to help them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all we can do, you know. But to look too far in the future, we don't really
have
know.
The capacity.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
More after the news here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Good evening. I'm Caroline Oh, together with Ezra Zayed, and this is the Evening Edition. We're in the middle of a conversation about baby abandonment and why the parents or young mothers do it. Now, joining us are Noor Aisha Osman from Orphan Care Foundation and Dr. Lai Swat Yan, Senior Lecturer of the Gender Studies Program, Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at University Malaya. So we've talked about the disturbing stats of how babies are abandoned and what the profile of these parents are. We've also touched on why they opt for this as a solution and how they deal with it socially and mentally after that. And everything seems to point back to the Asian mentality that we have and the fact that we can't talk about sex. So adults avoid discussing the topic altogether. And children, most of the time, are none the wiser. So Dr. Lai, isn't the answer here more sex education at every possible level? There's a huge discussion right now about what is age appropriate. At what level do kids start learning about sex?
I think sex education is very important because from one of the surveys that was conducted right by the ministry, they find that teenagers engage in sex in as young as 13 years old.
Right.
So based on that, I think they should actually be educated on sex education earlier on so that they know the consequences of engaging in sex. And the meaning of sex, you know, is not just... Because imagine if they look at pornography, right? That's not a very healthy way in which sometimes sex are being depicted. It's mainly physical, it's mainly pleasure, and also sometimes in some versions of pornography, women enjoy being sexually violated even. So I think it's very important that they actually have a more accurate representation or portrayal of what sex is so that they can better protect themselves. And also, I think recently there's also been cases of sexual grooming, right, involving children. And precisely, they actually didn't know that it's, you know, it's not right. So, and because of that, they couldn't protect themselves. So I think we need sex education also so that children are also, teenagers are also better able to protect themselves as well.
I don't think the issue is that we don't have sex education because we do.
Well, we don't really.
We do, yeah, not, but that's the thing, isn't it?
I mean, we have biology and we figure out where things swim.
Exactly, yes. But that's the question. But that therein lies the question. So what kind of sexual education, what approach should we be taking? I don't think there's any debate over the fact that we need it.
I think the meaning of sex is itself as well, you know, what it means. It's not just like, you know, okay, if you do this, then you get pregnant. I think if you just do that, it's kind of shortchange the whole act of sexual intimacy as well, right? And also the responsibility. Are you ready to be a parent, say, for example, to bring up a child if in case you get pregnant? Or if not, you know, contraception and whatnot, you know, what can you do, you know, in this age of it's actually transmitted diseases.
That's right.
So ones also need to protect themselves from that.
But what are the obstacles that are preventing from comprehensive sex education to be introduced in schools or in a way that's widely accessible?
I think the Asian cultural religious mindset that sex is actually taboo, and that if we talk about sex, we would actually encourage children to do it, teenagers to engage in it more. And because of that, I think the tendency is actually just to focus on the abstinence. And we know that that's not been working. A new direction is really needed.
And so how do we educate parents and educators and all sorts of other stakeholders to buy into this idea?
Because I think parents are especially important.
Yeah.
You know, like we were saying a little earlier, right? If your family doesn't support you, you don't feel as though you're comfortable or safe when you go to your family and say, I'm pregnant.
Or empowered to do so.
That's right.
This
has happened to me. But how do you do that with parents? We're not talking about a formal learning environment. How is that done? What's the best way, you think?
I think with parents, of course, I agree very much that, you know, it should start with the family, because I think at the end of the day, usually who would be there to support the teenager, right? Who's pregnant? It would be the parents. And I think the problem is nowadays is that parents are not spending enough time with the children. They are very busy. It's a materialistic, consumerist world, and everyone wants to make it, you know, to make it in society, right? And they're focusing very much in giving material things rather than spending time to, you know, to bond, to talk with their children. Because also sometimes if you feel parents are approachable, it's actually easier to talk with them. And I think what needs to be stressed is that, you know, even in school, right, activities that involve the parents being there as well. And of course, talking to children about sex should be part of it. And of course, a model could be developed to address that.
LPPKN has done this Sakata program, you know, where they introduce reproductive health awareness to students. I think that's at college level. I'm not so sure if it's at primary or secondary school level. I think that should be done at primary and secondary school level so that, you know, these children are made aware of, you know, the birds and the bees, you know, that issue in a more open way, you know.
So Aisha, you're having dealt with so many women as it was coming through your door, all these young mothers, you know, and talking to you. So you're saying that one of the important things to do is to have that talk with their parents. So for parents who are possibly dealing with this, having their children come up to them and saying this to them for the first time, Mom, Dad, you know, I'm pregnant. You know, obviously I'm not married. What am I going to do? So what would your advice be to these parents in order for them to be able to accept what their child is saying?
First of all, it would have to be, you know, stay calm. Approach the problem wisely in terms of, you know, you're the adult here. Your child may be 15 or 16, you know, think of a solution that would help your child. So if you wish to make an adoption plan, or if the child is already off, you know, no longer going to school and all that, whether she wants to parent her child, you know, and give the kind of support your child needs.
Give them the options.
Yeah.
Aisha, also this. Yeah, for those aware that there are some centres that help young single mums who don't want their babies, why is it they don't sign up for help at these places?
Perhaps for some of the mothers, the easy way out is just to get rid of the problem and not face the issue of having to bring up the child, because if you just abandon the child, then that's it, you don't have a problem anymore. But if you face the if you go to a center, and it requires a lot of courage, and you know, you have to answer questions and all that, and you have to decide what you want to do with the child.
Adelaide, I think that's also an interesting question about single young mothers who choose to raise their kids and not choose to abandon them. Mm-hmm. Apart from, you know, circumstances where there's a family structure to support that particular unit. There are a lot of them who are just doing it by themselves and perhaps need as much assistance as possible. Where can they go to receive, you know, support or to receive some sort of counselling and guidance towards managing the situation better?
I think the most important thing is actually from the family first, because if we look at some of the cases that's been reported as well, actually I was just going through, you know, some of the cases, you know, there was one, actually she decided to keep her baby also because in the case the family was very supportive. In her case also, you know, the father, she actually managed to talk to the boyfriend. The father actually, you know, wanted to take responsibility for it, and then they ended up getting married. So in those cases, I think it's actually much easier because at least they're bringing up the children as parents, right? But if she's a single mother, I think it would be a much more difficult thing because, yes, your family can support you, but on the other hand, you know, as you grow up also, you want it to be independent on your own, right? So I think skills training or whether there's a way for her to be able to continue her school after that, I think she needs that kind of support so that she can continue going back to school. And of course, I think in terms of counselling also, I guess it also depends if she feels she needs it. And then, of course, she could also go for that in terms of social and medical support and whatnot. Also because they find that teenagers who give birth, right, tend to have premature babies. And also, in general, maternal death is also much higher for women who get pregnant if they are a teenager. So things like that. I think social and medical support is actually very important. Of course, part of it is actually the family. But other than that, the social services support that they need. Okay, what happens if they want to go back to school? What happens if they want to, you know, later on to, if they want a skill or a training so that they can be independent on their own?
I think the one thing that needs to happen first is acceptance on all levels, you know, by society, that school kids are curious, they will engage in it. Acceptance by parents even, that sex is a topic to speak about with their children. Also by related government ministries, that there must be sex education modules where preventative measures other than abstinence can be practiced, because only then can young kids who find themselves pregnant be empowered enough to approach the issue of giving up or keeping their baby and not live with the guilt for the rest of their lives. And there is help out there, more so now than ever. Now, Orphan Care Foundation has set up baby hatches in PJ, Johor Bahru, Sungai Petani. It also collaborates with KPJ Healthcare Berhad, which has 8 baby hatches. Now, these are NGOs that are ready to help, and they're listed on the internet. Our thanks to Noaisha Osman from Orphan Care Foundation and Dr. Lai Swat Yun of University Malaya for joining us in this discussion today. Make sure you download our BFM app on your phone and you'll be able to listen to this podcast in case you missed any part of the show. It's Ezra and Caroline signing off for the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.